morning. It's really wonderful to be here. I just want to first of all just thank everybody who helped put this together, Rabbi Aaron Kraft, Kayla Eisenbach, Rabbi Brand, who facilitated this. It's really a pleasure, and thank you very much. Following Rabbi Brand's example, I will also just like to mention the inspiration for this year, and following Rabbi Brand's comment was indeed is Dr. Abraham S. Abraham, the author of Nishmat Avraham, who we quoted. He actually just came out with a third edition of his Sefer a week before Rosh Hashanah. And not only is he an eminent Talmud Chacham, he's also fairly accessible. I met him once at a conference, and I've been emailing him ever since. And he responds. Usually, if it's urgent, I'll write urgent, please respond. And someone needs to respond. And otherwise, if it's just, not urgent, at your leisure. Because I remember I was speaking to him at a conference, and I said, you know, he has a tremendous Sefer with all these weird and interesting cases. I said, you really came across all these cases? Like, I mean, he was the chairman of internal medicine in Shari Tzedek, so he had a vast experience, but it seems excessive. He says, no, absolutely not. He says, the way to do it is you make up stories, and you ask. And the more you ask, the more you know. So I take the same liberty with him. So I make up all these interesting cases, and he's wonderful. He's absolutely great. And he's really a source of a lot of inspiration for pretty much all everything I talk about in medical halacha. I usually run by him first, because he's an excellent source for it. He's a very humble man. He always calls himself a mailman. He doesn't. He won't determine any shilas on his own. He will only tell you what the gedolim have said, or what he believes that Rav Shlomo Zalman, or of Nevensal, or of Neuwirth, or would have said. In that case, he doesn't himself ever think that he's worthy of determining on his own. I think it's a very interesting meter to follow. So, turning to the other end of life, which is always exciting. We started with the beginning of life. We'll try to talk about on the other extreme right now, when you have to choose whose life to save. So often we're hopefully never stuck in situations where it's not clear. We have options, and we can't save everybody. We'd like to save everybody. We'd like to do whatever we can to save as many lives as possible. And sometimes that's just not possible. So we're going to talk about interesting cases where that's not going to be always possible. We're going to have to choose. We're going to be forced to make a decision. Not that we want to make a decision, but we're forced to make a decision sometimes. How are we going to make that decision? Whose life are we going to choose to save when we're forced to make that decision? And it's just important to remember that often these decisions are made in the spur of the moment. These decisions are made on the spot by somebody in a hostile situation, by somebody in an emergency room, under a lot of pressure, under a lot of stress, with a million things going on, and they're making a decision on the spot. And we should never think to judge someone's decision in that way. We have the ability now to sit back and reflect on it. And yes, it would be better if we had a protocol in mind, that we had theory and a system how to think about it. So that's what we're going to do now. We're going to try to develop, not going to give strict guidelines, we're going to develop some of the themes that should, the guidelines that, generally speaking, should apply. But it's just important to think about that we're never, ever should judge someone who's in the moment making these decisions, because we don't always know the whole story. We don't know what's going through their mind. We can't be in their position. And so while we're going to develop guidelines for it in the broad sense, those are good for making protocols and such. So for example, there was in New York City a couple years ago, there was, and all around the world, there was a scare of pandemic flu. H1N1 flu was spreading. There was a scare of pandemic flu. What should happen if many, many people in New York City come down with pandemic flu, with this very, very severe form of the flu? So what should we do? How are we going to treat them? So we know that flu is actually quite dangerous, particularly for the elderly, for the very elderly and the very young. Many diseases are much more severe for the very old and the very young. And so they're going to need treatment first. And so what's going to need their treatment? So some of them, well, the flu affects the respiratory system. They're not going to be able to breathe very well. So we're going to have to put them on a ventilator. A ventilator is a machine that you take a tube, you put it down the patient's throat, and it helps them breathe. It helps the patient breathe. And hopefully, by giving them that support and giving them fluids, and we don't give antibiotics for flu. We can't give antibiotics for flu, it doesn't work. But giving them all sorts of other support will help them get through that trauma, and they'll be better. Fine. We have a limited number of ventilators in New York City. New York City is a huge place, but we have a limited number of ventilators. So what should we do? We know the first couple of days of the flu, so who's going to come in? The very elderly and the very young are going to come in, because they're going to get sickest first. When they get sick, they're going to get very sick, and they're going to need that support. Now, unfortunately, we also know that they're also the group that's the least likely to make it through. Although they're going to come in first, a large percentage of them aren't going to make it. So we have to keep that in mind, because what's going to happen next? The next couple of days, we're going to have the healthier, middle-aged people and children who are coming in day 3 to 5 in that scenario that they were figuring out a couple of days later, and they're going to need ventilators. And are we going to have enough for them? Because we've already given them to the elderly and the very elderly and the very young, who are using them and we don't really know if they're going to make it. And a couple of days later, what's going to happen is a concern that we're going to have the medical staff isn't to get it. Right? The medical staff is going to be very careful and they're going to treat these patients and the first responders, the ambulances and the firemen and everyone who's exposed to these diseases are going to go and treat these people and they're going to use precautions. But we all know that as much precautions as we can use, often the medical staff can get sick. So now these are medical staff who are risking their lives, in theory, to save these people, and they're going to come in last. They're going to be sick last, in this scenario at least. So at least envision this scenario, they would come in last. So what do we do about them? So there are a couple of options. We could say, well, we'll save ventilators for the medical staff. We'll put ventilators on the side, because, well, we need to get the medical staff to take care of these people. Because if they don't take care of them, the whole story, then we're not saving anybody. So the medical staff's only going to be willing to do it if they have a guarantee that when they get sick, they'll be treated. So now what are we going to do? We're going to have 10 ventilators in the room. We're going to keep 3 of them for the medical staff. And let's say 8 people walk in on the first day. We're going to tell 7 people, sure, we can save you, but the 8th person, well, sorry, we have to save. The other 3 we're going to have to save for the later. Can we really do that? How are we going to judge when the first people come in? The first people come in, they have the least likely chance of making it. Are we going to sit there and say, well, your chance of making it are only 60%. Your chance of making it are 70%. So we'll treat the 70% and not the 60%. Where are we going to make that guideline? How are we going to choose that? Alternatively, what we can do is we can give everyone the first day that they come in. Whoever comes in will get a ventilator. And then on day 2, if people come in who are more likely to survive, well, we'll remove the first person from the ventilator and give it to the second person. Right? So in theory, you could do that. The problem is that when you do that, the first person who was on the ventilator, now he's dead. Because he needed that ventilator to live, and you gave it to him, and they took it away. So is that okay? You took it away, so now they're not going to make it through. There are all sorts of other scenarios. I came through the New York State Task Force on Life and the Law, which is not a religious organization, but has a lot of religious thinkers on it. Rabbi Bleich is on it, for example, and there are Catholic theologians on it also. Came up with a protocol of how to deal with this in New York City. Baruch Hashem, it was never a problem. It never became a problem where we needed to use so many ventilators. And it was not an issue. But how are you going to deal with that when people come and, well, we have sick people right now, and there are a bunch of people who I'm pretty certain are going to be sick tomorrow. They're not sick right now. But statistically speaking, I know they're going to be sick tomorrow. So how do I deal with that? What if 2 patients come at the same time? What about on day 3? I have an elderly person who the likelihood of him surviving is 20%, and he comes in the morning, and they have a middle-aged person, the likelihood of him surviving is 80%. These numbers I'm completely making up, so don't think that an elderly person only has a 20% chance of making it with the flu. I'm making this up. But let's say they make an assessment, they come in, and we have a supercomputer that can predict the number on the spot and tell you exactly how long the person's going to live. That's a very difficult science to figure out, a very difficult calculation to make. I'm not going to make it. But let's assume we could make that determination, and it's accurate. We always have to keep in mind that, what if it's wrong? What if the calculation's off? But let's assume the calculation's correct. So now what do? I have a 20% person, an 80% person, but the 20% person came first. How am I going to deal with this question? The same question came up recently now with the Ebola treatments. We have many, many people in West Africa who are dying from Ebola. And we had now we're developing more. I wasn't on top of the news in the last week or so, but we're developing more treatments, and there are doing trials, and they're not doing trials. Originally, we had very, 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 very limited amount of medication that we could offer these people, and very, very limited amount. We're talking only a handful of people. And the medication itself was uncertain if it's going to work. Not only is it uncertain if it's going to work, it might actually kill the person taking it. So who are we going to offer this treatment to? Should we offer the treatment to anybody? It's not tried and true. We don't really know if it's going to work. And what are we going to do? So one of the decisions that was made, and it's unclear, I don't know exactly how this decision was made, but they had a lot of missionary activity going on in West Africa and Liberia. And one of the missionary organizations wanted to give it to their missionaries. They said, well, they're there saving lives. So that's true if you're a religious missionary. They're saving lives. They're saving souls. They're not saving physical lives. They're saving spiritual lives. And they said, well, that's the most important thing that could be done, is that they're saving people's souls. And therefore, we should entice them to go back. We need people to go back and do this. This is more important than treating the doctors, even. This is more important than saving their lives, is saving their souls. And so they treated these 2 missionaries and 2 other people, 2 random people who didn't get that medication because they got it. Now, how are you going to determine? That was much more difficult because you only had a limited amount of medication and you have thousands of people now who are sick. I don't know how many presenting are each time. But how are you going to determine who to treat when multiple people come in with an illness? And with Ebola, we know very little about it. We know a lot, but on the other hand, we know very little. So I don't know if, especially in West Africa, if they're going to be able to figure out with that supercomputer what your chances of survival are. But let's assume you had it. How are you going to figure out who to try to treat and who not to treat? Again, with Ebola, it's much more complicated because the original medication was actually very risky. Now, we're hoping that with trials that the medication might be better and less risky, but at that point, the medication was quite risky, and they really didn't know if it was going to work or was going to kill the person, and they were afraid the patients were going to die anyway. Is it worth doing? Is it not worth doing? How are we going to make that decision? So let's start with a much more simple case. We're just trying to, how do we determine in a much simpler case how to save lives? Dr. Abraham himself was telling me that, unfortunately, there's a situation in Israel that happens, unfortunately, with some frequency. There's a terror attack. And when there's a terror attack, so different people come in, and people who die on the spot, unfortunately, you can't do anything about, but people are injured to various degrees. And so people come in, depending on how close they are to the blast, with various levels of injuries. So now, 2, 3, 4, 5, 8 people can come in at a time. And now you have to determine who to treat them. So now they're going to try to staff as much people as they can, and they know once there's a terror attack, they're going to call all the doctors in, and they do. But often there's just not enough to treat every single victim at a time. So while we'd like to do that, we can't, and then we're going to have to prioritize who are we going to treat. So in Israel, they actually have a system, and this was told by someone who was involved in the Boston the marathon bombing, that the reason that at the Boston Marathon very few people died, they said because they adopted the Israeli system. I don't know if this is true or not, but this is what the person told me. That there's two ways of treating people on the scene of a terror attack. You could try and stabilize them on the spot. Person's not stable. They've just been blown to bits. And I could try to save them. I could do whatever I can on the spot. Stabilize them. Make sure they're okay. And then transport them to the hospital where I could do more extensive work. Or I could do something called scoop and run. Pick them up as fast as I can and get them to the hospital as fast as I can. Thinking that in the hospital, the level of treatment they can get is so much greater. In Israel, they follow the scoop and run method. They try to bring as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, to the hospital. So in Israel, you're presented with this problem on a much more frequent basis. You're getting a lot of people coming at the same time. The person who was in charge, I forget what organization he was from, I apologize. He said that he was from Israel, and he was training doctors in Boston just randomly at one point for emergency response situations, and their EMT system adopted the Israeli scoop and run system, which they're crediting with the fact that even though many people were injured in the Boston Marathon bombing, few people died because they adopted the system of bringing people in as fast as possible. So in Israel, you're faced with this dilemma. Now you have many people brought in as fast as possible. You have multiple victims in front of you. What are you going to do? So it's important to realize that in halacha, so we have a concept called piguach nefesh, saving lives. And piguach nefesh pretty much trumps everything else. It trumps everything else other than the big three averos, murder, forbidden relationships, and avodah zarah. But it trumps everything else. It trumps Shabbos, it trumps kashrus, it trumps eating on Yom Kippur. Pretty much everything else, piguach nefesh trumps. Saving lives is a prime, not an ultimate value, again, because avodah zarah, forbidden relationships, and murder are above that. But it trumps pretty much everything else. So what does that mean, piguach nefesh? What do I have to do in order to save a life? What does that mean? So it's important to recognize that the Gemara, the Mishnah in Yom already says, the idea isn't necessarily that I'm going to return this person to his peak of health. I don't always have that ability. I'm not necessarily going to be able to cure a person. I can't always cure somebody. But I can help them last. I can help them live, survive a little bit more than they currently are. And the Gemara is clear that even in a case where I can only help them for a little bit, nonetheless, that's considered to be piguach nefesh. Even when I can help them survive just a little bit longer, that's also piguach nefesh. Piguach nefesh involves enhancing someone's life, quantity or quality, but quantity doesn't have to be, you know, before this accident, he had a life expectancy of 120. Unfortunately, you know, he's 115, and I can only get him to 116 right now. So that's also considered to be piguach nefesh, giving him that extra year. Even if I can't restore the original life expectancy, nonetheless, piguach nefesh also is involved in what we call chaye sha'a. Chaye sha'a meaning sha'a as opposed to chaye olam, meaning eternity. Not eternity. When we say chaye olam, we don't mean eternity, we mean a full life expectancy. Chaye sha'a is a more limited life expectancy. So it's true, this person's not going to survive as long as they would have before this accident, but I can grant them more life right now, and therefore, that's a mitzvah of piguach nefesh also. So helping someone and saving them, even for a little bit, is piguach nefesh to the extent I can we treat it the same way. I can violate Shabbos, and I can eat on Yom Kippur, and I can do whatever I need to help this person survive even a little bit. Because piguach nefesh means helping someone live. So if I'm helping him live, I can violate Shabbat. I can pretty much do whatever I need to keep this person alive. Now, I don't remember this one. So there's a Tosfos in Avodah Zarah. You can look at it if you choose. We're not going to go through it per se inside. There's a line in the Gemara that says, well, sometimes you can risk things, right? Are you allowed to put yourself at risk to try to save your life? So that's very interesting with the Ebola treatment right now. You may be putting yourself at risk. We don't know necessarily what the treatment's going to be. They're doing trials now, but before that, we don't know. So the Gemara assumes, yeah, chai sha, meaning if I take the treatment now, it might kill me right now. right? That's a possibility. But alternatively, if I take it, I might live longer, right? And if I don't do any, it might cure me. But if I don't do anything, I got an extra week. If I don't do anything, the doctors are giving me a week. They give me a pill. I can either take it now. If I take the pill now, I might live another 5 years. Alternatively, it might kill me on the spot. So a completely separate shear, not for our purposes right now, but sometimes it's okay, sometimes it's not okay. The Gemara assumes, hey, shah, that extra week, that's not meaningful. When you put it in perspective, it's not meaningful. So Tosfos there says, no. What does it mean that Chai Shah is not meaningful? Chai Shah is a short amount of life. It's meaningful and it's important, and the idea is we always want to do more. So yes, to violate Shabbos will do for Chai Shah. To eat on Yom Kippur will do for Chai Shah. And even allow you in certain circumstances to risk that Chai Shah. Why? Because you're going to win out in the end. The always goal is to try to extend life. So long as I'm extending life in a significant way, in an insignificant way, it doesn't really matter. So long as I'm in the process of extending life, I'm fulfilling the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh. And if I'm fulfilling the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh by extending life by even a short amount, no matter which patient comes to me, if I can help them even a little bit, if I can improve their situation more than they were before they got to me, I'm fulfilling the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh. And on the other extreme, it's just important to note that on the other end of life, I'm talking about the end of life, but on the other extreme, every moment's also important. And that's why the Rambam's going to write that no matter where a person is on the spectrum of life, whether they're just born or they're dying, I'm not allowed to kill anybody. I can never hasten death. I can never hasten death of anybody, no matter what situation they're in, no matter where they are. Because if you think about it, we use the term hastening death, and in the ethics literature they use it. Every murder is hastening death, meaning we're all going to die. I know, it's a little bit depressing after this morning's shiur about fertility. But it's going to happen. And we all know that. We know that. We're aware. It's not depressing, it's just something we need to be aware of. So hastening death is always going to... I mean, that's what every murder is, hastening death. Doesn't make a difference if it's the beginning of a person's life or at the end of a person's life. The Rambam's clear that hastening death at a person's life is considered murder. And Rabbi Emanuel Jacobovitz, who was the previous chief rabbi of England, his yahrzeit was actually this past Friday. So he was one of the first writers about Jewish medical ethics in English. One of the first, not necessarily the first, but he wrote about it in a very beautiful way. I always think there's a gift of being the British chief rabbi. You can write things in a very beautiful way. Something to aspire to. I think you need the accent, though. So he writes, he says, look, the way he explains it, he says, look, every moment of life is of infinite value. That's what the Torah teaches us. Every minute, moment of life has infinite value. So it doesn't make a difference if you have 30 years left, you have 30 minutes left, or you have 30 days left. Infinity is infinity. Infinity plus one is just infinity. Infinity is, that's it. It doesn't make a difference if it's 30 years, 30 days, 30 minutes, 30 seconds. I can never hasten that person's death.
What if someone's in severe pain?
I can never hasten death. Now, we're not talking about how to treat them.
Morphine.
So that's a...
The pain, but it also,
so that's a separate...
The respirations.
So...
It's
a complicated question for another area.
But
so you're right.
Valuable life is so. Pain?
From what the way I understand it at this point, and I think most pain specialists would agree with you, we can pretty much treat almost all pain. Not all. I think that's just a silly comment to say. Almost all pain, very, very, very well. Now, some of it may require someone to be made unconscious. Some of it may require put someone to sleep. Should we do that? Should we not do that? That's an interesting question. Do I have to treat someone in that level of at the end of life? Do I have to do everything that I can to keep them alive every moment as possible? Do I have to? Is a separate question. I'm never allowed to do anything active to end their life, if my intention is certainly to end their life. So when I give... The morphine's a complicated question, because I'm not giving them morphine to end their life. I'm giving them morphine to relieve their pain.
Also, it's going to depress the respiration.
So will it not? It's a complicated question. It's just... I'm going to leave it at that. We're certainly not allowed to do anything on purpose with the intention of ending someone's life, no matter what. But whether I have to continue treating them or not and pushing the limits, that's a separate question, much more complicated.
That's just intubating a 100-year-old person.
Do I have to do that? If I do, do I do pikuach nefesh? Yes. Am I obligated to do that? Separate question. Sorry. Apologize that wasn't helpful.
100-year-old mother-in-law.
Right. So I'm not dismissing it. Right. I'm just, that's not going to be our topic this morning.
In the Yom Kippur service, we read the martyrology, and in there, they talk about a Roman soldier removing what caused to hasten the death of
Rabbi Akiva, of Rabbi Chanan ben Tradion.
And he goes to heaven. So how does that reconcile the...
So that is a question that has plagued many, many, many commentators for years. I'm just going to leave it at that. There's an excellent survey of it in the tradition. Later, Rabbi J. David Bleich wrote an article about it, surveying all the positions. It's Rabbi Chanina ben Tradyon, famous story. He was burnt alive, and the burning was going very slowly, and so the Roman soldier, guard, who was in charge of monitoring this, said, "Is there anything I can do to hasten your death?" And he said, "Well, if you remove the cotton from that was blocking his heart, which was wet, supposedly preventing him from burning quickly." Unclear what Rabbi Akiva meant by that. Unclear what he said. He said, "If you remove that, I'll die sooner." So the Roman does it and dies sooner. The problem is that his students, while he's dying, his students ask him, "Why didn't you open up your mouth?" And the assumption was, if you open up your mouth, you'll die faster. Leave aside the science behind that. So he says, "No, I'm not going to do anything. Let the one who gave me life take it away from me. I'm not going to act." Then the next line in the Gemara is, but then the Roman guy asks him, "Can I take away the cotton?" And he says, "Yes." So how do you reconcile those two stories? How do you understand Rabbi Chanina ben Tradyon? It's a fascinating, fascinating topic. Not for now. We're going to assume that on the whole, hastening death, doing something active to end life, is forbidden. That again doesn't necessarily mean we have to do everything to promote it at all costs, no matter what. But hastening death, doing something active, is forbidden. Okay? Fine. So he also thinks, or Rabbi Jacobowitz points out, that if you think that life is of infinite value, so every moment is of infinite value, so you really can't compare infinities, so infinity equals infinity equals infinity, and that's it. He says, secondly, from a moral perspective, if you don't value the last moments of life, he thinks you've devalued all of life. Because what you've done is you've said, well, there's certain life that's worthwhile, and certain life that's not worthwhile. And who's going to make that determination? How are you going to determine? Once you're ready to say this life is more valuable than another life, you've devalued the value of life, period. And that's already a problem, a moral problem in and of itself. So that's how he explains this idea, and I think he does it very nicely. Fine. So now we have a situation where I know that even extending life ephemerally, only for a little bit, even for a day or 2 days, is pigoach nefesh. And I have another patient, so I have two patients coming in front of me. One who, look, this person's really injured. I can save him. We can sort of support him for a little bit. We really don't think he's going to survive more than the week. I can do what I can. I don't know. We don't know. So assuming we have this supercomputer that's going to tell us what the statistics are, we're not going to be able to determine it on the spot. But the person's really not going to survive. And I have another patient who comes in, and you know the injuries are much less. So again, we don't know, and this is not in our control, but nonetheless, I still have to deal with the percentages that I'm dealt with. Not because I can predict the future, but because I have to deal with reality right now. Statistically speaking, this guy has a 20% chance of surviving. This guy has an 80% chance of surviving, but I can only treat one of them at a time. So, but they're both a mitzvah of pikuach nefesh. Because treating the guy who only lived for another week is just as much pikuach nefesh as the mitzvah of treating the guy who can live for another 100 years. So how am I ever going to choose between the two? We have an intuitive feeling. I'd like to treat the guy who's going to live 100 years. Because I just feel like I'm doing something more important. But how do I make that determination? How do I say, well, one life is worth more? Am I not valuing what's going on? How do I determine which mitzvah I should do? Well, what if it makes a difference? Does it make a difference who comes in first? Does it make a difference who comes in first? I'm involved in that mitzvah. So there's an idea that we know in halacha that we might think, for example, it depends on success. Am I going to succeed in treating him? So let's say it's not statistics of how long he can live. This guy's only going to live a week. This guy's only going to live 80%. I don't know. I'm going to try my best to save him, but I don't know if it's going to work. I have two patients. I just don't know if it's... We don't know the extent of his injuries. He comes in after a blast, unfortunately, in Israel. He comes in from Ebola, and we have very, especially in West Africa, the diagnostic ability of many of these clinics, if they have clinics, is very limited. We don't really know. So we're going to try to save him. So is that a mitzvah of pikuach nefesh? Is it a mitzvah of pikuach nefesh? So think about the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh for a moment. What is that mitzvah? Is it a mitzvah is to save someone's life? So, or to extend life? What if I'm not successful? What if I tried and tried and tried and tried and tried? I'm doing CPR for 45 minutes. It doesn't work. It didn't work. I tried. I violated Shabbos. I drove on Shabbos to save him. I used the defibrillator. I shocked him. I did all sorts of violations of Shabbos. It didn't work. So, did I violate Shabbos? Or did I do the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh? So, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, in the second source on the sheet, it's a little bit of an opposite case, but it's similar. The Shulchan Aruch says, "Amdu arofim shetzarech grogeres achas." So, for whatever reason, the Gemara assumes that figs are very life-saving. That they always use examples of figs to save someone's life. So the doctors assume that this patient, if he had one fig, saved his life. Unclear exactly what that means, but let's use that as a model. He needs one fig. Fine. V'ratzu asara v'yivyu lo kol achad grogeres. So this is in shul. Someone collapses in shul. Doctor gets up and says, "We need one fig." So everyone's like, "Okay, pikuach nefesh. We're going to go. This is great. This is the most important mitzvah we can do." 10 people run out and pick figs off the tree. And everyone comes back, but he only needs one fig. So now I have 10 figs. So I have 9 people who violated, I have 10 people who violated Shabbos. Only one fig is necessary. What about the other 10? She says, kulam p'turim. They're all exempt. Why? Because they all tried to do the mitzvah pikuach nefesh. Trying to do the mitzvah pikuach nefesh is part of the mitzvah, even if you don't accomplish. And now, the Shulchan Aruch does something special here. So normally, Shulchan Aruch is a book of laws. He doesn't give you moral reasonings. He doesn't give you ideas in philosophy. He just tells you the rule. Kulam p'turim, they're all exempt. Wonderful. He goes farther than that. Here he says, v'yesh lehem sachar tov me'et Hashem afilu hivri barishona. And each one of them gets rewarded from God. Each one of them gets rewarded from God. Which is interesting for the Shulchan Aruch to include that. Why is he including that? So first of all, it could mean he wants people to do this. Why? Because if everyone says, if I'm one of the 9, how do I know if I'm going to be the 1 of the 9? So I don't know. So nobody's going to run out and get the fig. If the halacha was that only one person fulfills the mitzvah and 9 don't, I have a concern now, right? Because nobody's going to run and get that fig. So it could be encouraging everybody to do it, but I think it's more than that. I think it's a lot more than that. I think it's showing that it's the attempt to do pikuach nefesh. It's the pikuach nefesh is not necessarily the goal. It's the attempt to do it. The action of trying to save the life, which is the mitzvah. If we think back to Rabbi Brand's presentation, so Rabbi Schechter and Rabbi Bleich all have the same idea, a little bit differently than Rabbi Yaakov Ariel presented it, talking about the mitzvah of Puravu. Mitzvah of Puravu, the outcome, again, is not in my hands. We all know that. We all are very well aware that having children is not something that we can necessarily control completely. We can do our best, but it's not in our control. So how could God command us to have children? If it's not something I can control, how can God command us to have children? This is one of the questions Rabbi Ariel asked. And one of his answers was, no, it's asakta b'piriyah v'rivyah. Did you try? Did you put in the effort? Did you do that which you need to do? And Rabbi Brand discussed, what do I have to do? What do I not have to do? But did you do? Did you try? Did you make the effort? Even if you didn't accomplish the goal, asakta b'piriyah v'rivyah, did you do it? Did you try? If you tried, that's the mitzvah. God can't command me to do something that I don't have control over. I can only be commanded to do that which I can do. I have no control over whether I have the children or not. I have control over what effort I put into it. So what effort I have to put into it, what effort I don't have to put into it, in light of modern technology is interesting. But so too here. I can't control the outcome whether this person is going to live or die. It's all in God's hands. We can try our best. Sometimes we think we saved a person, all of a sudden it doesn't work. Sometimes we think a person's gone, and all of a sudden they come right back. There was a case in the news last week of this woman who had one girl, twins, I don't remember if they had a C-section, and all of a sudden she went to cardiac arrest, her heart stopped, and they started working on her, they started doing CPR, and her heart was not coming back, and they gave up. And a couple of minutes later, her heart came back, and she's now perfectly healthy. She had no brain damage, she had no neurological damage. She's fine. This is actually down the block from where I live in Boca Regional Hospital. It's strange, because in the shul full of doctors, not one person was in that room. So, I just wanted to hear the story from somebody who was there. Not that I doubt that it was true, but it's cool to hear the story from somebody who was there, so nobody in our shul was there. But sometimes, we don't know. So it's not up to me again. But it's the effort that I put into it. Pikuach nefesh is trying to save a life. It's not necessarily the outcome of saving a life. So I can't judge again, am I going to be successful or not? That's not going to tell me whether the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh or not. My attempt to save the life is the mitzvah. So now I have 2 attempts to save a life. It can't tell me, well, you're going to succeed or not succeed. How is that going to be able to help me determine who to save? Because my effort of doing the mitzvah is also part of is pikuach nefesh. They're both the same level of pikuach nefesh. So now the question is, okay, so if it's not about success and how I'm going to be successful in treating, maybe it's successful of who's in danger. So let's take a simpler situation. I have 2 people, one may be sick and one might not be. They're not both sick. One might be ill and one might not be ill. One might be in danger, one might not be in danger. So Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein, Rav Eliezer's son-in-law, he's a fascinating person. He writes about fascinating cases, and I asked Dr. Abraham once, did he do the same thing that Dr. Abraham does? Because some of these cases that he gets are so wild, so out there, that you really wonder if they really happened. And for years, he's published articles in different places. He finally published a set of books. It's 5 volumes called Shiurei Torah LaRofim, Torah Shiurim for Doctors. It's not all about medicine. It's all about life in some way. And he has letters from people who actually signed their name that asked all of these questions. It's fascinating. It's fascinating to me that, first of all, people ask all of these crazy questions. He has questions of someone of soldiers parachuting down, and one parachute got stuck, and one guy cut the cord. These crazy, crazy cases that came to him. So he deals with a lot of these cases. So he says, let's say you have dangerous road conditions on the, this is a real story, on the road from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem is not completely straight, and at night, I haven't been there in a number of years, but the lighting situation there is not so great. And so let's say there was a problem on the road, and the car veered off the road, and it turned over. And so now, there was something on the road that caused this car to turn off. And so now the persons in the car want to know, well, what should he do now? Should he try to help the other people in the car who are now need help? Because he's not exactly sure what their situation is, but they're in a flipped over car on the side of the road between Yerushalayim and Tel Aviv. Or should he get back into the middle of the road and stand in front of that obstacle that was there and prevent other cars from going off the road? So what should he do? So Rav Zilberstein said, well, let's think about it. We have someone who's certainly in danger. The person in the car who's flipped over is bleeding. He's certainly in danger. Find out if they're in danger. If they're in danger, so they're in danger right now. The other cars that are coming, are there cars coming? Are there not cars coming? Even if a car comes, is he going to hit the same road, hit the same brick that was on the floor or not? I don't know. So what I have is a case of someone who's certainly in danger and someone who's only questionably in danger. And in that case, I have to save the person who's certainly in danger. When I have a vadai, a certainty, and a suffix, and an uncertainty, I should always try to treat the one who's certainly in danger. Because if you think about it, that's the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to save. And here I have more of a certainty to fulfill the mitzvah. It's a horrible other cases he was asked about, interesting suicide bombers and infiltrating terrorists into kibbutzim, and he has stories of the terrorists came into the kibbutz and he started killing people or trying to kill people. And so now people are chasing after him to try to stop him. So what should they do? Should they sit there and tend to the people who are injured, who we're not sure if they're dead, they're dying, they're certainly not in good shape? Should I help them, or should I chase the guy and prevent him from killing other people? So it gets very, very challenging. The same thing with a suicide bomber. He said, a suicide bomber, we see him running, and this was another case that happened. He stabbed someone on the way, and then he said, I'm going to go and explode he yelled Allahu Akbar, and you saw that he had a detonator on him. These are all real cases. Should they chase the guy, or should they try to help the guy who was hurt first? So he tries to figure out what's a vaday and what's a suffix, and tries to figure out in different situations what the story is going to be. And he says, well, whenever you have a vada and a suffix, it's not always easy to determine. Again, we should never judge anybody in these situations. These are lightning decisions that are made on the spot. We should never judge them. But he says, in theory, we should always try to treat the certain danger as opposed to the suffix danger. He has the same case about, this came up again in this Operation Cast Lead over the, was that, a, no, it wasn't Cast Lead, it was
Protective Edge.
Protective Edge, Tzuk Eitan. The translation from Hebrew to English with the operation names doesn't really work. But the operation this past summer, so they had this situation which was asked. You have a unit going forward, and they have a paramedic with them. They have a military paramedic with them. And so now so they have 15 people going, let's say, and their mission is to secure some post or to take out some missile site. There's a missile site that they know they need to take it out. They have intelligence that this is going to be used later today. And they have to take it out, and they're limited by the time they can do that because they want to do it before it's light. This was early in the day before the sun came up, and they want to do it under the cover of darkness. And all of a sudden, one or two of the people got injured on the way. One or two people got injured on the way, and so now they only have 12 people left, let's say. And so what should this medic do? Should the medic stay back and treat these people and take them back? Or should he continue with the unit knowing that what he's doing is he's preventing a missile from being shot at another village? So, again, the question is, well, who's in danger and who's not in danger? And you have to figure it out, and not so simple. Well, these people, are they certainly in danger? How injured are they? Are they dying or not dying? And what are we going to do? Is the mission going to continue? Because if the mission continues, if the medic stays back and the mission continues, and he's taking care of those people who are ill right now, who are let's say, dangerously, let's say we're shot, and he's taking care of them to try to save their lives. So now these 12 guys, so they're going to secure that post, they're going to take out that missile site. They know there's no medic. So they know that their medic stayed back. So are they going to fight as effectively? Or are they going to be more defensive? Are they going to accomplish their goal? Again, their goal is to prevent more death. Their goal is to take out a missile site so it doesn't hit another village, it doesn't hit another city, and kill innocent people. So which is a vaday and which is a suffix? Very, very, very unclear in this situation. And what's the medic's responsibility? Very complicated, very complicated. I'm not going to tell you how to deal with the situation, but the question is, well, we have to determine, the guideline is, well, who's certainly in danger and who's suffix in danger? And if we could figure out when we have a certain danger and only a questionable danger, we should always go with the vaday danger instead of the questionable danger, and that's how we should figure it out. That's the way it makes a lot of sense. So there's a Sefer Cheker Halacha, he says, I don't understand. He says, look, let's say someone on Shabbos in the shul clutches their chest like this and says, oh my chest is hurting. So I said this joke in my shul in Boca Raton where I think we had like 10 or 15 cardiologists in the room. So let's say there's no doctor around. So it depends on the situation whether there's a doctor around or not. So the person could either be having heartburn, right? Let's say the person's never had heartburn before. He could be having heartburn, and how do you treat heartburn? You could take a Tums and he'll be fine, right? And this person will be fine. Or he could be having a heart attack. So there's no doctor in the room. We don't know. The person goes like this, oh my God, my chest really hurts. And I don't exactly know how to figure out. They're not being so verbal. They don't speak such good English. They're like this. It hurts. So is it heartburn or is it a heart attack? Because if it's heartburn, then we give him Tums. If it's a heart attack, I'm going to rush him to the hospital and say Shabbos. So what do I do? So it's Safik Pikuach Nefesh. Let's say I can't tell. I really have no training. I can't tell. God doesn't speak English. So I take him to the hospital. Why? But it could be nothing. It could turn out to be heartburn. It could turn out to be either deadly or it could turn out to be nothing. It doesn't make a difference. Safik Pikuach Nefesh is like Pikuach Nefesh. We treat every Safik of Pikuach Nefesh just like Pikuach Nefesh. So how could it be then, the Chekar Halacha asks, that when I have a case of Vadei Pikuach Nefesh and Safik Pikuach Nefesh, that I always go with the Vadei? Don't I treat every case of Safik Pikuach Nefesh just as seriously as I do Pikuach Nefesh? On Shabbos, I know I will Mechal Shabbos. The din is, I'm forced to Mechal Shabbos. I don't sit there and wait for the cardiologist to show up. I'm not allowed to. The Shulchan Aruch writes that Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos is an important thing to do. And you have to do it, and you shouldn't think you're Mechal Shabbos if you do it. And not only that, but if you ask a question, if you go and ask the Rav, should I or shouldn't you, HaReza Shofech Damim, you might be causing this person's death. But the Shulchan Aruch goes further than that. It quotes Yerushalmi that says, Hanish al HaReza Megune. The person who's asked, he's also to be rebuked. Why? He's the rabbi. You should teach people. If there's a case of Safek Pikuach Nefesh, don't ask me a question. Don't ask me. If it's ever a question, act. If it's Safek Pikuach Nefesh, if you're not concerned, if you're concerned that this person may have a life-threatening illness, don't ask questions. Just act. Just go. So he asks, but it's Safek Pikuach Nefesh. So don't we treat everything the same? Now, intuitively, we know something here is wrong. Intuitively, we'd like to try to promote life as much as possible. We'd like to go with the statistics. So how is that going to work? Halachically, we seem to be in a bind. We know that saving even a little bit of life is a mitzvah. We know that we're treating Safek Pikuach Nefesh just like Vadei Pikuach Nefesh. Any attempt to save life is just as important. So how are we going to deal with that? So if you look, there's two sources for saving life. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, Ayin Gimel Amud Aleph, gives two sources for saving life. It's not in the sheet. So the two sources are, very interestingly, the first mitzvah is V'hashevos Alo, the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. There's a mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, just like if you lost your purse, you lost your iPad, you lost your notebook, if anyone still has those anymore. So I have to return it to you. That's a mitzvah. I have to return it to you. So too, the Gemara says, if you're losing your health, I have to return it to you. Just like I have to return your lost object, I have to return your lost health. The Gemara then brings another proof, another pasuk. We're not going to get into why we need two. The Gemara asks this. It says there's another idea called lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. Don't stand idly by your friend's blood. What does that mean, don't stand idly by your friend's blood? The Gemara explains, if you see your friend's blood being spilled, meaning their life is in danger, don't stand idly by. Do something. We get you from both ends. There's a positive mitzvah, do something, and don't stand idly by. Don't just stand there and be passive. Do something. So Rabbi Bleich points out the following. He says, let's say a person lost their iPad, and I'm trying to return it to them, and I don't succeed. I don't find the guy, I don't return it to him. So did I fulfill the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda? No. Hashavas Aveda means you return the lost object. So Vashevos Alo is you return the lost object. When I return that object, so I fulfill the mitzvah. If I don't return the object, I didn't do anything. I was trying. It was my thing. If you want to pick up a lulav, and you have a lulav and etrog, and you pick up the lulav and etrog, but you realize that I'm missing hadassim and aravot, I'm going to do it. You didn't fulfill the mitzvah. You didn't do anything. You have to do the mitzvah properly. You only have to accomplish the mitzvah. Let's say the etrog's too big. There was a guy in my shul, there was a Temani guy, who had an etrog that was quite large. So some of the kids wanted to lift it. So most of the adults were able to do so. But if you can't lift the etrog and hold it with the lulav at the same time, you can't lift it. I wanted to. It's a beautiful etrog. I wanted to lift it, but you didn't. So that's great. You tried, the effort is noteworthy, and I have no idea how this works in the divine calculus and whether you get reward or not get reward. But you didn't do the mitzvah. You didn't do the mitzvah. You didn't accomplish the goal. But on the other hand, lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, don't stand idly by. What is the Torah obligating us to do? It says, don't be passive. Do something. Don't stand idly by. So I fulfill that mitzvah by not standing idly by doing. Even if I don't necessarily accomplish the goal. So long as I'm not standing idly by, I'm doing something, I'm fulfilling the mitzvah. Doing something productive, not just, you know, doing a rain dance. I have to be doing something towards saving this person's life. As long as I'm doing something towards saving that person's life, I'm not standing idly by. I'm trying my best to save that person's life. Which is why the attempt at CPR is a mitzvah. Because, lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, you're right. I didn't bring this person back. I didn't save his life. I didn't. So there's no mitzvah v'ashevos alo. I didn't fulfill that mitzvah v'ashevos alo. But nonetheless, I fulfilled the mitzvah, the negative mitzvah written in the positive mitzvah written in a negative way. Of lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, I didn't stand idly by. I did something. The Torah doesn't want us to be passive. It wants us to be active. And so long as I'm active in trying to save this person's life, I didn't stand idly by and I accomplished that. So Rabbi Bleich explains all of these things are true. So when I have a suffix and a vadai, what do I really have? I have a certainty and an uncertainty. I have two mitzvot, really. When I have a vadai pikuach nefesh, I can certainly save this person's life. Let's say, certainly, again, to the best of our knowledge and ability, I'll fulfill the mitzvah of Vashivo, so I returned his life. And lo tamid al damrayach, I didn't say that Levi, I did something. When a person's suffake, and I don't know if I can save him or not, I wouldn't fulfill necessarily mitzvah vashivosalo, but I'll certainly fulfill the mitzvah of lo tamar ol damarecha. So he says, the reason you can always make these decisions is because it's a question of halacha calculus. If you have the opportunity to do two mitzvahs, or the opportunity to do one mitzvah, you should always opt for two over one. Given that they're equal, I should always try to do two mitzvahs as opposed to one mitzvah. So if I have the mitzvah of vashivosalo and lo tamar ol damarecha, meaning I can save the person's life, so you're right, it's pikuach nefesh, so I'll do it. On the other hand, if over here I don't have vashivosalo, I won't necessarily save the person's life completely. I don't know if I'll be successful, but I'll certainly fulfill the mitzvah of Hashivosalo. Of lo tamar ol damarecha. So that's also mitzvah of pikuach nefesh. You're right. That'll allow me to violate Shabbos, and that will allow me to do everything I need to do to save the person's life. But when I put the two, and I have to compare the two, and I have to weigh them against each other, I'll always go with two over one. So that's how I'm able to choose when I have to choose two over one, whether there's a certainty or not. So now what? Yes. There was an article in Times of Israel about this Thursday or Friday. Not halachically, just emotionally. I encourage you to read it. I remember asking Dr. Abraham this question.
You treat the patient closest to you.
We'll get to that. We're about to discuss that. But let's say the terrorist comes in Israel. They do treat everybody equally who comes in. And the person writing this article, now I feel uncomfortable even commenting about it. How could I ever? I don't know how you could put yourself in that situation. I asked Dr. Abraham once this question. He said he's not an emergency room physician, but he was in the emergency room after a terrorist attack, and a terrorist came in, and somebody else came in, and the terrorist was in worse shape than the other person.
So what do you do? The ethics says the person closest.
Yeah.
You don't step over.
So there was this article was written, and so this person pointed out, you know, there was two attacks last week in Israel, the past 2 weeks about. It was like a hit and run. And the car ran into someone and he ran over. It was a bus, I think, and a tractor. And then there was another case in Alon Shvut, where they also, a car hit, went over a sidewalk and hit some people. And they assumed it was just a parallel terror attack, and it turned out that it wasn't. It was just a car accident. It wasn't for terrorist reasons. The person happened to have been an Arab, and he happened to have lost control of his... That's what they determined. Let's assume that that's correct. So he says, when that person came in, we assumed he was a terrorist. But it turned out he wasn't. So he says, you always have to be careful how you label people when they come in. Because you might be wrong. So sometimes you're not wrong because he's wearing this belt. And so he says, this is the head of the trauma department there was writing this. He says, whenever a patient comes into the hospital, the only label we give them is patient. Whether that's right or wrong is that's a very hard question. That's a very hard question. Should we have more rahmanis on the victims than on the perpetrator? Generally speaking, I want to say yes, right? I mean, just intuitively, But on the other hand, we treat everybody. Someone comes in, we need to help them. And we have limited resources. Should I now spend... Yeah, not easy. But I encourage you to read that article. Again, it's not halachic conclusions, but it's this person's reflections on doing it. It was really last week in Times of Israel.
What was the name of the article?
I don't know, but I'll email Rabbi Kraft. It was in Times of Israel last week. It was about... I recall reading it. I don't remember the name of the article. I don't remember who wrote it. It was fairly moving. Yeah, I would never want to be in that situation. Well, yes?
There's one main difference here, that the perpetrator, in effect, has already given up his life.
Yes.
And he's already, you know, I think, come to grips with the fact that he will probably die.
And he'd like to, in fact. And he might, even if not caught, if he's a suicide bomber, he's trying to kill himself, and he actually failed.
Right, so if he failed and he's there, and he's injured, and the other people are there who are you're talking about a different value system.
The question
is, if a person has given up his life, or he actually, his intent was to give up his life, and another level is, he's a non-Jew.
So all complicated questions. Just briefly, don't want to address it necessarily, briefly, we will treat an attempted suicide. We treat an attempted suicide just like we treat everybody else. So let's leave the political aspect out of it. Just because then the emotions are just get the better of us. Maybe it should. I'm not saying the emotions shouldn't get the better of us when we're talking about politics and national issues. Maybe they should. But just to think about it theoretically, at least, we will treat a suicide attempt. We will, and now the suicide victim, against their will, think about it. The person who's committing suicide, let's assume it's a rational suicide, whatever that means. in states at least that it's illegal to do so. So they're trying to kill themselves. They don't want you to save their life, right? They're trying to kill themselves. Nonetheless, we'll treat them seemingly against their will. They couldn't make a clearer statement of, please don't save my life, than trying to kill themselves. But nonetheless, we will try to do so. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. But that's how we act. So should that apply to a terrorist or not? I don't know. And the terrorist also evokes much more serious issues that not only did he try to kill himself, he tried to kill other people. He's a really bad guy. I don't want him to live. I prefer if he dies. I mean, given that he accomplished what he wanted to accomplish or he didn't accomplish, I prefer that he not be around anymore. Because if I save him, he might do it again. He might encourage other people. Do I really want to use my resources? It's very hard just to talk about it and not get emotional about it. So I'm not going to. Let's just talk about the victim so far. And we only have a couple more minutes, so we'll briefly hit upon some of the other issues that are involved. So let's say, again, someone brought up before, well, who do I have to treat first? So let's say they're both besakana, both people come in, they're both at risk. It's pikuach nefesh. I don't know who I can treat better. I don't know necessarily if I'll be successful with more or the other. What do I do if they're both equal, let's say? Both equal, not exactly equal. Again, remember, we're making these judgments on the fly. So we have a concept in the Gemara. It says, ein mavirin ala mitzvos. You're not allowed to pass by a mitzvah. The mitzvah comes to you, you can't pass by it. So the first mitzvah that comes, you have to do it. So the first person that comes in is the first attempt of the mitzvah. Let's say I think I could save his life, so I have the mitzvah of Asher Voselo, and I have the mitzvah of Lo Tzamad Al Merecha. So he comes in, and what I should do is, the first person that comes in, I should save their life. Now what if I know, because they're radioing me from the scene of the attack, that the first person that comes in is the most injured. Why? He's the closest to the blast. He's the closest to the blast, he's the one they're going to bring in first. His chances of living are much less. The person who's farther away, their chances of living are greater, let's say, in that situation. Again, depends on the situation. And they radio me in, and now I know the first guy who's coming in, if I now spend time treating this person, and if he's the most injured, let's say, for example, I'm going to need more equipment, and more people, and more resources invested in this guy than I will in the next one, but the next one, I could save his life. Or better, let's say I'll need 10 people to treat this guy, and I have two more people coming in that I could use 5 each. So now I could save 2 people or 1 person, but the person coming ahead of me is first. Is the person coming in first is the one who needs 10. So now what do I do? So there's a question of Ein Ma'avirin Al Mitzvos. Tosfos says that the idea of Ein Ma'avirin Al Mitzvos is when I have two different mitzvahs that I have to choose between the two. When I can do both. When I can do both, so then I have to do the first one first and the second one second. But when I can't do both, when I'm forced to choose, that doesn't necessarily apply. There's a fascinating question that Radvaz was asked. He says there's a person stuck in a jail and I don't remember where the story was. He was in Egypt. I don't know where the question's coming from. And he was given 1 day to go out to pray. So his question was, well, what should I do? Which day should I choose? Should I choose Rosh Hashanah and I'll hear a shofar? Should I choose Megillah? Should I choose Purim? Because it's Megillah is a Pirsum Enesa. If I go on Rosh Hashanah, I won't put on tefillin. If I go on Purim, I'll put on tefillin. Maybe I should go on Pesach. So Radvaz says, no. Go out today. The first day they give you, go out. Because right now, you need to pray Shacharis. You need to put on tefillin today and say Shacharis today. Your mitzvah is today to put on Shacharis. You're missing that mitzvah. You have to do that first. Do that mitzvah first. Because I have two opportunities. It's the same mitzvah. He assumes it's all the same mitzvah. You can do it first. And you should do the first mitzvah that comes to your hands, do it first. He also says, well, you don't know if they'll change their mind in 5 minutes. Right? These are not the... These are strange situations. So again, is it completely parallel or not? Regardless, the Chacham Tzvi, he says, no. When you have two mitzvahs, when you have the same mitzvah in front of you, let's say it's today or Purim, right? So there's tefillin in both cases, so it's easy to put out. It's easy to figure out. Shabbos and Yom Hashanah is different. You have either today or Purim, they're giving you the option. Today you'll fulfill the mitzvah of Shacharis and tefillin, it'll be great. On Purim you'll fulfill the mitzvah of Shacharis and tefillin and Megillah. It's a better mitzvah. It's the same mitzvah, but it's enhanced. When you can do the same mitzvah in an enhanced way, then you should choose to do the same mitzvah in an enhanced way, even if you have to wait. So we're running out of time. But getting back to now, how are we going to deal with these two patients? So the question is, if I have a patient who has an 80% chance of living, let's say I can, if I'm successful now, I give this guy an extra 6 months with this patient. If I'm successful with this guy, I give him an extra 5 years. Right? That's what we're going to work on now. Let's just make that assumption. So how am I going to choose again? It's the same pikuach nefesh, is that v'ashe vosel olo samar olam recha? So the way many posts, Rabbi Zilberstein writes about it, or Rabbi Bleich writes about it, it says, look, you can do a mitzvah in an enhanced way. There's something called hiddur mitzvah. Doing a mitzvah in a more beautiful way. I have a more beautiful esrog, I have a more beautiful tefillin, I buy a more beautiful megillah, a more beautiful sefer Torah. I could do a mitzvah in an enhanced way, or I could do a mitzvah in the simplest way. So they write that there's a hiddur mitzvah to save more life. Meaning, although life is infinite, right, and each moment of life is infinite, on some level, here's more and here's less. if I can fulfill the mitzvah by giving this guy 5 years and giving this guy only 6 months, and again, I'm not doing anything to hasten this person's death, I'm forced to choose. It's not my choice. I wouldn't want to choose. I'm forced to choose. Then I should try to save more life, if I have the option of saving more life or less life. Now what happens when it's the same question I had before? I have the first guy who comes in, I give him 6 months, and I have, and require 10 people, and I have two guys who come in, they can have each one of them have 3 months. Unclear a little bit. And then what does that mean to save more life? Does that mean just number of years? Does that mean just number of years, or does that mean till their life expectancy? So I can give somebody 10 years, so let's say he's 50, and he would have lived till 120. He would have lived 120, so that gives him 70 more years, right? So now I can give him 60 years. So, but it won't be to his life expectancy. Or I have a guy who's 110, and I give him 10 years. So that everyone, in my examples, everyone lives till 120. It's easier. Don't insult anybody usually that way. So everyone's going 120. So this guy can give 60 years, but he'll only live to 110. And this guy's 110, I give him his 10 years, and he'll live his full life expectancy. So one, I'm giving 60, one, I'm giving 10. So is that the system I do, 60 versus 10? Or do I say, no, well, this guy can bring up to his life expectancy, even though it's 10, and this guy can't bring to his life expectancy. So is that how I evaluate it? So most poskim are going to assume, and this is not the question that most poskim assume, but or talk about very explicitly, but there is an idea of hider mitzvah, that intuitive feeling that that I feel the least, based on the nodding before, I'm going to assume that many people, it resonates with people, is that when I can save more life, I will. When I have a choice of saving more years or fewer years, and I'm forced to choose, I'm going to go with the more years over the fewer years, because that's part of a hider mitzvah. So even though we said there's a mitzvah to save every moment, we said there's a mitzvah of chayei shah, even extending someone's life even a little bit is a mitzvah. So how am I ever going to evaluate? We then said, well, my likelihood of success isn't a factor here, because my likelihood of success is irrelevant, because it's the attempt to save a life that really matters. And we said that you see that by the two different mitzvahs that we have. There's a mitzvah of ashevoselo, of saving a life, and the mitzvah of lo samen al dam reyecha, just not standing idly by. And so long as I don't stand idly by, so long as I'm not standing idly by, I'm fulfilling that mitzvah. And while I fulfill that mitzvah, so then that helps me do in even these questionable cases. But when I have to choose between the two, I have two mitzvahs versus one mitzvah, I'm going to be able to choose the two mitzvahs over the one mitzvah. I'm going to be able to do a mitzvah calculus. But when it gets to more complicated questions where it's equal on both sides, it's either one mitzvah or two for this guy, and one mitzvah or two for this guy, and I have to be able to choose, how am I going to choose how much life to save, how much life flat to save? So there are proofs for this. I apologize, we're not going to get into it right now. But there's an idea of hider mitzvah, that when I can save more life, then I should do that. So I think that's the intuitive feeling that we all feel. I think that's what the halacha is trying to inculcate within us, that we talk about these end-of-life issues, I think, and I have a certain fascination with them, just one moment, that I think because it helps us highlight the importance of every moment. And it can be a depressing thought, but it could also be an inspiring thought. It's a depressing thought when you think of every moment at life, at the end, is a person suffering, not suffering, and that's something we have to deal with. Again, separate idea. But if we think about it for ourselves, just every moment is really of infinite value, and we try to live like that, I think that's a certainly an inspiring message that I think these halachos are trying to teach us. Want to take questions now, or privately? Yes. So, you had the guy putting in a coma. It might not be that he's suffering. Let's say the person's actually going to suffer, like actual physical pain and agony. So it's a good question. How does that factor in? Does a person's, and we assume that nobody's speaking. All the victims are silent, right? All the victims in my situations were silent. They're all terror victims or something like that. What if the person says, "I don't want it"? It's interesting. It's going to be a factor. We're going to have to figure out how to figure that in. This was assuming all things being equal again. But you're right, these are all important factors to take into consideration. Yeah.
Could you go back to the pandemic where a patient comes in and they need a respirator and they're 80 years old, and so far that's the only person you see, but you only have a limited number of respirators. So are you obligated to put it on that patient at that time?
So the New York State Task Force on Life and the Law put, I believe what they did was they put a number. Meaning, it's a question also with admitting to an ICU. Who would I admit to an ICU? Who do I not admit to an ICU? Right, the intensive care unit of a hospital. I only have X number of beds. So I have a bed right now, so do I admit this person who in all likelihood isn't going to make it out of the ICU? Or do I save that bed because tomorrow I might have somebody else? So again, they had a very, 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 very complicated rubric of, are we in a pandemic? Are we not in a pandemic? How do I know if I'm in a pandemic or not? How many patients am I expecting to have in the next 24 hours? They have a very complicated structure for it. And what is this person's chancing of survival? And it's not like 60% or 61%. They had like, If you're between, they had all sorts of categories to help you assess it and all sorts of different rules. But what they did was, if there is a statistical risk, the statistical risk has to reach a certain level, that we're going to be flooded with patients in the next 24 hours, and this person's chance of survival is less than X, we're not going to give it to him. So the halacha hasn't really caught up to this yet, but in theory it would be, well, how serious? Well, again, we take statistical risk very seriously. A statistical risk is a risk, as long as it reaches a certain level. Do you want me to stop? So I'm going to stop right now. If anyone would like to speak briefly afterwards, I'm happy to take some questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.